characteristics that are inherently desirable without regard to whether or not the organism survived, such as intelligence, strength, or, to take something really obvious, a tendency to avoid eating poison. In one experiment attempting to prove evolution, and those are the only evolution experiments allowed by law, fruit flies were bred to avoid eating poison. One would think that if we could settle on one characteristic that is a priori fit, it would be avoids eating poison. Alas, the fruit flies bred to avoid eating poison did not survive. They died out, while the original dumb fruit flies with no aversion to eating poison survived to reproduce. Thus, the scientists concluded, stupid is more fit. As the headline in The New Scientist put it, cleverness may carry survival costs. Yes, it's been observed for centuries that it's the truly stupid who are the most successful, live the longest, are the happiest, the wealthiest, the most desirable, and so on. Let's face it, it's the stupid who have the inside track in this world. This is what's known as a theory incapable of disproof, or perhaps a theory born of self-interest. The fruit fly experiment is now cited as scientific proof of evolution. So whenever you hear about the overwhelming scientific evidence for evolution, remember that evolutionists have put the fruit fly poison-eating experiment in their win column. Or consider the argument for evolution made in the New York Times Science section based on the human appendix. After describing how the appendix is a useless organ that can kill you, the author snidely remarks, "You sometimes hear people who say they reject evolution's claim that our bodies show clear signs of being intelligently designed. I wonder how many of them have had appendicitis." As I understand the concept behind survival of the fittest, the appendix doesn't do much for the theory of evolution either. How does a survival of the fittest regime evolve an organ that kills the host organism? Why hasn't evolution evolved the appendix away? Another sign that your scientific theory is in trouble when your argument against an opposing theory also disproves your own. For those of you opposed to faith being taught in the classroom, reflect on the answer the Times gave. Imagine a trait that helps an animal survive to adulthood, but that also has side effects that can cause trouble later in life. If, on balance, animals produce more offspring with the trait than without it, natural selection will favor it. Perhaps the appendix lifted the odds that our ancestors could resist childhood diseases and live to childbearing years. Even if it also caused deaths by appendicitis, the appendix might have been a net plus. So there it is. The theory of evolution is proved again. When the appendix use was a mystery, it proved evolution. When the appendix was thought to help humans resist childhood diseases, well, that proved evolution too. Throw in enough words like imagine, perhaps, and might have, and you've got yourself a scientific theory. How about this? Imagine a giant raccoon passed gas, and perhaps the resulting gas might have created the vast variety of life we see on Earth. And if you don't accept the giant raccoon flatulence theory for the origin of life, you must be a fundamentalist Christian nut who believes the Earth is flat. That's basically how the argument for evolution goes. You'll begin to notice that the evolution cultists' answer to everything is the punchline to the joke about the economist. A physicist, a chemist, and an economist are stranded on a desert island with one can of food, but no can opener. The physicist says, "If we drop the can from 30 meters, the velocity plus the force will break the can open." The chemist says, "We could heat the can to 101 degrees Celsius, and the boiling reaction will burst the can." The Economist says, assume a can opener. That's all you ever get from evolution cultists. Assume a can opener. Assume each one of the many, many mutations necessary to create a complicated structure, like a cell or an eye, is itself beneficial and somehow makes the organism more fit. Assume completely random mutations, all individually beneficial, could come together in 200 individual parts to form a perfectly functioning mechanism such as the flagellum. Assume the appendix is a cornucopia of unknown benefits until it kills you. Assume eating poison is good for you. These people make L. Ron Hubbard look like Aristotle. They ridicule us for saying, the Bible is true because it says so right in the Bible, which I've never said, by the way. Then they expect us to swallow their circular argument in support of Darwinism. To paraphrase Chico Marx, who are you going to believe, me or your brilliantly designed eyes? Step 3. Creating a new species is still on evolution's to-do list. We haven't even gotten to the third prong of Darwin's theory of evolution, the point of the whole contraption, and we've already had to assume miracles and stifle giggles at the key definitional term, fittest. The big payoff of the theory that must be taught as scientific fact to small school children throughout America is this. If we combine 1. Absurd assumptions about random mutation with 2. A tautology, survival of the fittest, we get a whole new species. If you get your news from the American news media, it will come as a surprise to learn that when Darwin first published The Origin of the Species in 1859, his most virulent opponents were not fundamentalist Christians, but paleontologists. It was a nice yarn Darwin had spun, but there was absolutely nothing in the fossil record to support it. Far from showing gradual change, with one species slowly giving way to another, as Darwin hypothesized, the fossil record showed vast numbers of new species suddenly appearing out of nowhere, remaining largely unchanged for millions of years, and then disappearing, almost like there was a big flood or something. Darwin's response was to say, start looking. He blamed the absence of fossil support for his theory on the extreme imperfection of the geological record. With a little elbow grease, he was sure paleontologists would soon produce the necessary evidence. Well, we've been looking for 150 years now. We've found a lot of fossils, and what the fossil record shows is new species suddenly appearing out of nowhere, remaining largely unchanged for millions of years, and then suddenly disappearing. In 1979, David Raup, a geologist at the Field Museum of Natural History in Chicago, described the problem this way. The evidence we find in the geologic record is not nearly as compatible with Darwinian natural selection as we would like it to be. Darwin was completely aware of this. He was embarrassed by the fossil record because it didn't look the way he predicted it would, and as a result, he devoted a long section of his Origin of Species to an attempt to explain and rationalize the differences. There were several problems, but the principal one was that the geologic record did not then, and still does not yield, a finely graduated chain of slow and progressive evolution. Things have only gotten worse in the intervening 20 years. It was one thing for Darwin to rationalize the lack of fossil evidence on the grounds that only a small portion of the world is known with accuracy. It's another thing entirely for today's biologists to be still clinging to the argument from ignorance. 150 years have passed, with vast awards and accolades dangling before any paleontologist who could locate a fossil proving evolution. Dr. Ropp said, "We are now about 120 years after Darwin, and the knowledge of the fossil record has been greatly expanded. We now have 250,000 fossil species, but the situation hasn't changed much. The record of evolution is still surprisingly jerky, and, ironically, we have even fewer examples of evolutionary transitions than we had in Darwin's time. By this, I mean that some of the classic cases of Darwinian change in the fossil record, such as the evolution of the horse in North America, have had to be discarded or modified as a result of more detailed information. What appeared to be a nice, simple progression when relatively few data were available now appears to be much more complex and much less gradualistic. Darwin's disciples simply assert that evolution led from this species to that by the process of random mutation, with cruel nature striking down the genetic losers, and to hell with the fossil records showing nothing of the sort. At some point, it's not even pseudoscience anymore. It's just a crazy religious cult. If mutations are utterly random, as Darwinism claims, there ought to be an infinite variety of transitional animals with small mutations that eventually led to a magnificent new attribute like a wing or a lung. Unlike most high school biology teachers lying to your children about evolution, Darwin was at least aware of what the fossil record ought to show if his theory was correct. He said there would be interminable varieties, connecting together all the extinct and existing forms of life by the finest graduated steps. But we don't have interminable varieties. We don't have fossils connecting the extinct to the extant. We don't have the finest graduated steps. What the fossil record shows is sudden bursts of all manner of animals, modest change, and then sudden and total extinction. Dinosaurs appeared, lived for 150 million years, and then disappeared, only to be quickly replaced with mammals. Neither the creation nor the extinction of dinosaurs was accomplished by a gradual process of any sort. You also never see the mutations that turned out to be clunkers, like the dog that mutated webbed feet, or the fish that mutated fur. To the contrary, all the changes always seem to follow a straight line. But if the mutations were really random, with Mother Nature ruthlessly striking down the genetic losers, then for every mutation that was desirable, there ought to be a staggering number that are undesirable. Otherwise, the mutations aren't random. They are deliberate. And then you get into all the hocus-pocus about an intelligent designer and will probably start speaking in tongues and going to NASCAR races. But that's not what the fossil record shows. We don't have fossils for the vast quantity of hapless creatures that ought to have died out in a survival of the fittest regime. The evolution cultists hypothesize, since this is a real science as opposed to intelligent design, which is just a bunch of crazy conjectures, that the bad mutations didn't stick around long enough to leave fossils. Pay no attention to the man behind the curtain. The clunkier mutations simply never fossilized. And why are you asking so many questions? Or they revert to Darwin's excuse of 150 years ago about the paucity of the fossil record. If that explains anything, it only explains why we wouldn't find one particular unfit mutation, say if we went looking only for the dog with webbed feet. It doesn't explain why we don't find any bad mutations. A dog that mutated antennae or gills or a tail on its head. In order to mutate the good stuff, like a bird's lung, there would have to be countless mutations that were at least better than what existed before. If each one of the incremental mutations is more fit than what preceded it, which it has to be in order to survive, those transitional mutations should have stayed around long enough to appear in the fossil record before mutating their way to something even better. But in the course of millions and millions of years, all we see are slight variations on the final product. There is no reason to expect, for example, that the first place our eyes ever appeared was on the front of our faces. Why don't we have ancestors with eyes on the bottom of their feet, on their arms, or on the top of their heads? Eyes might be best positioned in the front of our heads, but eyes on the bottom of our feet are better than no eyes at all, and so should have stuck around at least for a while in the fossil record. But they're not there. We're not talking about the swan on NBC. This is evolution. This is the completely accidental process that created butterfly wings, bat radar, the human brain, and the millions of species alive today. The theory of evolution requires hundreds, thousands, maybe millions of mutations just to create an eye. No one has any idea how many mutations would be required to create an eye. A process that is supposed to have transformed an amoeba into Jerry Garcia by random mutation must have produced some spectacular failures. Why can't we find any of the amusing ones? The late Harvard paleontologist Stephen Jay Gould, one of evolution's most passionate defenders, called the extreme rarity of transitional animals the trade secret of paleontology. He said, "The evolutionary trees that adorn our textbooks have data only at the tips and nodes of the branches. The rest is inference, however reasonable, not the evidence of fossils." Gould was also the guy who tried to disprove the idea of IQ and lost that debate, too. Poor Gould will go down in history as the Robert E. Lee of science, the last passionate defender of lost causes. Paleontologist and evolutionary biologist Robert Carroll admits, "Very few intermediates between groups are known from the fossil record." For over 100 years, evolutionists proudly pointed to the same sad bird-like animal, Archaeopteryx, as their lone transitional fossil linking dinosaurs and birds. Discovered a few years after Darwin published The Origin of Species, Archaeopteryx was instantly hailed as the transitional species that proved Darwin's theory. This unfortunate creature had wings, feathers, teeth, claws, and a long bony tail. If it flew at all, it didn't fly very well. Alas, it is now agreed that poor Archaeopteryx is no relation of modern birds. It's just a dead end. It transitioned to nothing. But could Archaeopteryx be our one example of bad mutations eliminated by natural selection? Archaeopteryx can't fill that role either, because it seems to have no predecessors. The fossils that look like Archaeopteryx lived millions of years after Archaeopteryx, and the fossils that preceded Archaeopteryx look nothing at all like it. The bizarre bird is just an odd creation that came out of nowhere and went nowhere, much like Air America Radio. The Washington Post defended the state religion by referring to evidence that does not exist, the countless bad mutations, in order to rationalize the apparent designed progression of the fossil record. This appearance of perfect fit makes it seem as if organisms must have been the product of an intelligent force. But this appearance of perfection is deceiving. It gives no hint of the numberless evolutionary dead ends, Lineages that, according to the fossil record, survived for a while but then died out, probably because changes in the environment made their once perfect designs not so perfect anymore. That would have been a creditable defense of the Darwiniacs' crackpot religion in 1859. But if there were, as Darwin supposed and the Washington Post asserts 150 years later in defiance of the facts, numberless evolutionary dead ends, we ought to have found a whole bunch of them by now. In fact, we ought to have found more dead ends than evolutionary advances. A lot more. Niles Eldridge, Gould's collaborator, has devoted himself to reconciling evolutionary theory with the fossil record. But even Eldridge complained of the famous evolutionary horse sequence purporting to show diminutive horses evolving into modern stallions, saying the sequence is entirely speculative and yet is presented as the literal truth in textbook after textbook. Evolutionary biologist Jerry Coyne at the University of Chicago claims it is flat wrong to say that the fossil record does not show a smooth, unambiguous transitional series linking, let's say, the first small horse to today's horse. Coyne ought to apply for a job at the American Museum of Natural History. Much to its embarrassment, the museum has had to rearrange its famous horse sequence. The more advances paleontologists make in uncovering the fossil record, the more absurd the evolution fable becomes. Most nettlesome for evolutionists is the Cambrian period, showing a vast quantity of plants and animals appearing on the scene in the blink of an evolutionary eye more than 500 million years ago. In a period of less than 10 million years, there is a sudden explosion of nearly all the animal phyla we have today. As leading Darwin cultist Richard Dawkins describes the Cambrian fossils, it is as though they were just planted there without evolutionary history. Darwin himself referred to the great difficulty of explaining the absence of vast piles of strata rich in fossils before the Cambrian explosion. Origin of Species thumpers prefer to ignore the Cambrian explosion and prattle instead about the evolution of girl crushes, as one article did in the New York Times style section. Social scientists suspect such emotions are part of women's nature, feelings that evolution may have favored because they helped women bond with one another and work cooperatively. And you know how cooperative we gals are. This is where all the deep thinking about evolution is being done these days, in the social sciences and the style section of the New York Times. Or the Darwiniacs lie about the duration of the Cambrian period, as Jerry Coyne does to nerd public policy wonks reading The New Republic who don't know any better. Referring to the so-called Cambrian explosion as if even the name is a fraud, Coyne writes, "Short period here means geologically short, in this case 10 million to 30 million years. This is both misleading and false, which isn't easy. The best estimate for the duration of the Cambrian explosion is not 10 to 30 million years, as evolutionists like Coyne often claim, but 5 to 10 million years. And that is the maximum length. When dealing with rocks half a billion years old, it's impossible to resolve times to less than 5 to 10 million years, just as with a telescope, it's impossible to distinguish two faraway objects if they are close together. In other words, the explosion of animal life could have happened in an instant, but from our present perspective, we can't narrow it down to anything more precise than a window of about 5 to 10 million years. If intelligent design is a crackpot theory being hawked by religious nuts, why are its opponents the ones always caught telling big whoppers? These great practitioners of the scientific method, dispassionately pursuing the evidence wherever it may lead, simply pretend the Cambrian explosion didn't happen. The so-called Cambrian explosion, as Coyne says. And anyone who mentions it is a creationist nut. The New York Times will write honestly about Air America's ratings before high school biology textbooks will tell the truth about the Cambrian explosion. When forced to pony up an answer, Darwin's disciples say, assume a can opener. Assume that the creatures that preceded the Cambrian era failed to fossilize, as they said about the intermediate fossils that also aren't there. Assume they were soft-bodied creatures, evolving like mad, but leaving no record because of their squishy little microscopic bodies. Yes, that would explain it. The evolutionists had no evidence to support that assumption, but at least it couldn't be disproved, so it was at least on a par with the flatulent raccoon theory of life's origins. Alas, in 1984, Chinese paleontologists discovered fossils just preceding the Cambrian era, and it turned out the pre-Cambrian creatures were extraordinarily well-preserved. But instead of a glut of evolutionary ancestors, all we have at the outset of the Cambrian explosion are some sad little worms and sponges. The interesting thing about the pre-Cambrian organisms is that they are soft-bodied, microscopic creatures, precisely the sort of animal the evolution cult claimed wouldn't fossilize and therefore deprived them of crucial evidence. But now it turned out fossilization was not merely possible in the pre-Cambrian era. The pre-Cambrian beds were positively ideal for fossilization, better even than in the Cambrian period. And yet, the only thing paleontologists found there was a few worms. The Chinese fossil discovery was, as the New York Times put it, among the most spectacular in this century. Scientists were calling it Genesis material. The discovery showed that the dramatic transformation of life from primeval single-cell organisms to the complex multicellular precursors of modern fauna was more sudden, swift, and widespread than scientists had thought. For 3 billion years, nothing but bacteria and worms, and then suddenly nearly all the phyla of animal life appeared within a mere 5 to 10 million years, as though they were just planted there. Jan Bergstrom, a paleontologist who examined the Chinese fossils, said the Cambrian period was not evolution, it was a revolution. Even the famously difficult-to-evolve eye appeared at the beginning of the Cambrian period, and there were no light-sensitive pits. And yet, in 2005, or 2 decades after the discovery of the Chinese fossils, the New Scientist was still clinging to Darwin's speculation that the first eyes probably evolved from light-sensitive cells. At least, when Darwin invoked light-sensitive pits, it was merely question-begging. The assertion of the light-sensitive pits hypothesis after the discovery of the Chinese fossils is a religious belief held in defiance of the facts. Andrew Knoll, Harvard professor of natural history, described the importance of the Chinese fossils, saying, "Most of everything that was going to happen, all the ways of making invertebrate animals, had already happened by the mid-Cambrian. Now, it seems, the new life forms were invented within the first few million years of the Cambrian." Unable to keep using the excuse that they had no fossil evidence because their evidence failed to fossilize, The Darwiniacs quietly returned to pretending the Cambrian explosion never happened. In 2005, Jerry Coyne was still trying to pass off the hard-to-fossilize argument to readers of the New Republic, writing, "We still do not understand why many groups originated in even this relatively short time, although it may reflect an artifact. The evolution of easily fossilized hard parts suddenly made organisms capable of being fossilized. 20 years after the Chinese fossils were discovered, Coyne was still pretending not to have heard of them. The preposterous conceit that the fossil record has produced a beautiful mosaic of organisms consistent with evolution, except for the occasional gap, is absurd. Evolution is nothing but a gap. It's a conjecture about how species might have arisen that is contradicted by the fossil record and by nearly everything we have learned about molecular biology since Darwin's day. Things do evolve in a figurative sense. The fifth draft of a script is usually better than the first draft. People do get taller when there's more protein in their diets. Ellen DeGeneres' third TV show is better than her first two were. Okay, fine. The cult cites evidence that looks like Michelangelo's studies for the Sistine Chapel and then claims it has proved the absence of a designer and brings lawsuits to prevent anyone from saying otherwise. Scientists in communist China have more freedom of speech to discuss scientific facts bearing on evolution than we do in the United States. Chen Jun-Wan of the Nanjing Institute of Geology and Paleontology, who performed the excavations, says that contrary to Darwin's Tree of Life, which predicts a few primitive organisms gradually branching out into many others, the fossil record shows just the opposite. The base is wide, Dr. Chen says, and gradually narrows. Chen concluded, "Darwinism is maybe only telling a part of the story for evolution." Fortunately, Dr. Chen is not in Dover, Pennsylvania, or Judge John E. Jones III would have prohibited him from saying that. Meanwhile, when a high school biology teacher in America tries to tell his students about the Chinese fossils, he is banned from teaching biology. Roger DeHart used to teach biology at Burlington Edison High School in Washington State, where he supplemented his curriculum with newspaper stories on the Chinese fossils from newspapers like the Boston Globe and the New York Times. He never mentioned God. The ACLU threatened to sue, and the school removed DeHart from his class, replacing him with a recent Teachers College graduate who had majored in physical education. Thus were the students of Burlington Edison High School saved from having to hear scientific facts that might cause them to question their faith in the official state religion. The liberal clergy prohibit students from hearing about a fossil bed described in the New York Times as among the most spectacular in this century. Then they say it's because they want to keep faith out of the classroom. The Cambrian period isn't a small gap in the fossil record, chock full of evolutionary evidence. There is no evidence in the fossil record, only ingenious excuses, as Berkeley Law professor Philip Johnson says. Remarking on the discovery of the Precambrian fossils in China, primitive chordate specialist Nicholas Holland of San Diego's Scripps Institution of Oceanography said, "You just hardly know what order to put the material in now. I mean, you might as well just present the phyla alphabetically. It's come to that." As Gould admits when he says transitional forms are generally lacking at the species level, even the cult members can't point to fossils showing the transition from one species to another, which I gather is the general point of the theory of evolution, subtly alluded to in the title of Darwin's book, The Origin of Species. The sad state of the fossil record has led to a schism in the Church of Evolution. Both sets of Darwin's disciples demand that we assume miracles to reconcile Darwinism with the fossil record, but the two branches disagree passionately about whose miracle is more convincing. As already mentioned, the neo-Darwinists respond to all problems in the fossil record by asking us to assume all the creatures we would expect to find if evolution was true and really did exist, really, but somehow never fossilized. Their hated rivals, the Darwin revisionists, tend to reside at places like Harvard and the American Museum of Natural History, and have too much intellectual pride to subscribe to a clunky, obvious miracle like none of the animals that would support our theory fossilized. Consequently, the revisionists have given up on trying to defend the fossil record as consistent with evolution. Instead, the revisionists concocted a more sophisticated supernatural occurrence. The miracle proposed by Gould and Niles Eldridge, a curator at the American Museum of Natural History, is called punctuated equilibrium. The gist of punctuated equilibrium is evolution, but this time, let's make it consistent with the fossil record. Instead of gradual change occurring by random mutation and natural selection, choosing the most fit to survive and reproduce, in other words, Darwin's theory of evolution, Gould and Eldridge hypothesized that evolution could also happen really fast and then stop happening at all for 150 million years. Basically, what happens is this. Your parents are slugs, and then suddenly, but totally at random, you evolve into a gecko, and your brother evolves into a shark, and your sister evolves into a polar bear, and the guy down the street evolves into a porpoise, and so on. And then everyone relaxes by the pool for 150 million years, virtually unchanged. The important thing is, this happened completely by chance. In other words, the most prominent apologist for evolution came up with a theory of evolution that's not evolution. It's a non-theological miracle. Chapter 9. Proof for how the Walkman evolved into the iPod by random mutation. Darwiniacs do not have a single observable example of one species evolving into another by the Darwinian mechanism of variation and selection. All they have is a story. It is a story that inspires fanatical devotion from the cult simply because their story excludes a creator. They have seized upon something that looks like progress from primitive life forms to more complex life forms and invented a story to explain how the various categories of animals originated. But animal sequences do not prove that the Darwinian mechanism of natural selection caused the similarities. It is just as likely that the similarities are proof of intelligent design, creationism, or the giant raccoon's flatulence theory. The animal sequence drawings allegedly demonstrating evolution by showing, for example, a little runt horse gradually becoming a grand stallion are just that, drawings. Evolutionists act as if they were the first people on Earth to notice similarities among various species, but this wasn't a new concept. Biologists had always grouped animals by what they looked like. No one disputes that a monkey looks like a human, especially in the case of Al Franken. Evolution fetishists then position the different species in a make-believe tree of life and announce that they have proved evolution. The capacity to draw a diagram and come up with a story about how things might have happened is not science. Janet Reno looks like Elton John. That is not proof that Janet Reno gave birth to Elton John. The seductiveness of Darwinism resides in its confusion of similar structures with the engine of creation. The Darwinian sleight of hand consists of the claim that because a human hand, for example, is similar to a bat's wing, there must be an ancestral relationship. Clearly, apes look like us, but that doesn't mean there is a lineal connection between us and the apes. It certainly does not establish the mechanism responsible for the differences. Despite the cult members' occasional calm assurances that this animal evolved into that, we have no idea whatsoever if one animal descended from another. Fossils do not reveal parent-descendant relationships. It's all guesswork, requiring frequent revision in light of new fossil discoveries. The animal sequence drawings in biology textbooks are presented as if they are hard fact, and then, a few years later, new fossil discoveries require the sequence to be completely disassembled, rearranged, and put back together again. Then the all-new animal sequence drawing is presented as if it were hard fact, and the existence of an earlier, completely different sequence drawing is flushed down the memory hole. But every few years, the Darwiniacs find some odd creature that looks a little like another creature, and it is triumphantly announced that evolution has been proved true. Thus, for example, on April 6, 2006, the New York Times gave prime front page above the fold space to an article headlined, "Fossil Called Missing Link from Sea to Land Animals." The article quoted unnamed scientists as saying that this discovery should undercut the argument that there is no evidence in the fossil record of one kind of creature becoming another kind. So they found an odd-looking fish with weird appendages and pronounced the missing link between fish and land animals. But only if evolution is assumed to be true is there any basis for assuming that the fish is related to fishes without appendages or to land animals, much less for assuming that each step was produced by a brutal battle of survival of the fittest. And there is no reason to assume evolution is true until, among other things, the Darwiniacs can produce a whole glut of transitional animals, i.e., an entirely new fossil record. The successive appearance of more complex species does seem to show something that looks like progress, but that has nothing to do with the Darwinian mechanism of natural selection. One also sees progress in the Wright brothers' increasingly complex airplanes, a master's paintings, and the advance from the Peace Pipe to Marlboro Lights, progressions all notable for being the product of intelligent designers. The appearance of progress hardly establishes mutation and natural selection as the engine of change. To the contrary, the similarities that so mesmerize Darwiniacs look more like the progress of a designed object than the result of a series of lucky accidents. Far from the fantastic competition of a dog-eat-dog struggle to survive, we see a fossil record that reveals a rather clean, well-organized sequence. This is why Stephen Jay Gould referred to the absence of transitional fossils as the trade secret of paleontology. As a consolation prize to evolution's lackeys who still wanted to believe the fossil record wasn't a complete bust, Gould offered this hopeful spin. Transitional forms are generally lacking at the species level, but they are abundant between larger groups. Transitional forms between larger groups means evolutionists can point to reptiles appearing in the fossil record, followed by mammal-like reptiles, followed by mammals. This, they say, proves the mammals came from the reptiles. They have no idea if the reptiles are even related to the mammal-like reptiles, much less to the mammals. Again, fossils do not reveal a parent-descendant relationship. The cultists certainly don't know whether any particular mammal descended from any particular reptile. But more important, the apparent progress from simple animals to more sophisticated, higher animals with no transitional species looks a lot more like planned, deliberate progress than a series of random mutations. Darwiniacs love to cite, for example, the progress from the reptile's multi-boned jaw to the jaw of mammal-like reptiles with fewer bones, leading inexorably to the single-boned mammal jawbone with two bones moving to the ear. The jawbone metamorphosis didn't prove evolution, but here at last was one small part of the fossil record that was not wildly inconsistent with the theory of evolution, in contradistinction to the Cambrian period and the absence of transitional species, for example. That's proof when it comes to the state religion. For not disproving evolution, the vertebrate jawbone is said to prove evolution. Michael Moore's essence is consistent with the flatulent raccoon theory for the origin of life. On Darwiniac's standard of proof for themselves, the flatulent raccoon theory has thus been proved true. In fact, and to the contrary, the much-celebrated migration of the reptile jawbone raises more questions for the theory of evolution than it answers. How did that happen? How, that is, did those bones figure out just where to go? One would think that if they had perfect independence in migrating anywhere, the bones would have landed all over the place. But no, we have no evidence over the course of the reptile-to-mammal transition that those wandering bones had any other destination in mind than the one they ultimately found. When asked for proof, all evolutionists can do is point to structural differences in broad categories of animals, the larger groups mentioned by Gould, as if the very thing they were trying to explain constituted an explanation. Yes, we know a lizard is different from a squirrel. Despite the claims of Darwin's apostles, people knew that even before Darwin. The question is, was it the process of natural selection that turned the lizard into the squirrel? The evolutionists' proof is their capacity to concoct a story. They say the whale evolved when a bear fell into the ocean. The bat evolved when squirrels developed flaps that helped them leap longer distances and fall to the ground more slowly. This isn't a joke. Cult member Richard Dawkins writes in Climbing Mount Improbable, "To begin with, an ancestor like an ordinary squirrel, living up trees without any special gliding membrane, leaps across short gaps. It could leap farther if it had something to slow a fall. So natural selection favors individuals with slightly pouchy skin around the arm or leg joints, and this becomes the norm. Now, any individuals with an even larger skin web can leap a few inches further. So in later generations, this extension of skin becomes the norm, and so on. It is possible that true flying, as seen in bats, birds, and pterosaurs, evolved from gliding ancestors like these. Most of these animals can control their direction and speed of their glide so as to land at a predetermined spot. It is easy to imagine true flapping flight evolving from repetition of the muscular movements used to control glide direction, so average time to landing is gradually postponed over evolutionary time. But unlike a squirrel, the bat has a complicated set of elongated bones to support powered wings and, most famously, a sophisticated form of sonar. How did all that evolve without making the squirrel less fit? Elongated bones would help a bat fly, but it's hard to see how they would make a squirrel more fit rather than gangly, unsteady, and slow. Needless to say, these hypothesized half-squirrel, half-bat animals do not appear anywhere in the fossil record. So, however persuasive one finds the squirrel falling from a tree explanation for the evolution of the bat, there are no fossils to support it. To the contrary, the bat appears in the fossil record millions of years ago, fully formed and largely indistinguishable from today's bats. But Darwiniacs have a squirrel, and they have a bat, and they have a story. Their idea of a scientific theory makes psychic readings look like a hard science. Moreover, if all species evolved from the same single-celled organism, beginning in the same little mud puddle, why hasn't the earthworm made a little more progress? Was it never, ever desirable in any of the worm's many dirt holes to mutate eyes or legs or wings or a brain? How could one clump of cells starting in the same little puddle become a human being while others never make it past the amoeba stage? Forget getting to humans, which liberals rank as the lowest form of life. Why hasn't the earthworm evolved into a beagle? Just for being cute, a beagle can acquire a 6-room co-op apartment on Park Avenue. Surely an evolutionary advantage. The cult members are especially dazzled by the similar DNA in all living creatures. The human genome is 98.7% identical with the chimpanzees. On the basis of this intriguing fact, psychology professor Roger Fouts of Central Washington University argues that humans are simply odd-looking apes. In a book titled Next of Kin, What Chimpanzees Have Taught Me About Who We Are. Except the genome argument proves too much. The human genome is 35% identical to that of a daffodil. I think even a Darwiniac would admit humans are not 35% identical to a daffodil. Again, the cult's smoking gun of evolutionary proof turns out to be an imaginary water pistol. The mountains of evidence for evolution we keep hearing about mostly consists of changes less impressive than those produced every day at the Bliss Spa in New York City. Now and then, nature gives some species a Botox shot, but it generally wears off and the basic model returns. Finches on the Galapagos Islands with deeper beaks begin to outnumber finches with shallower beaks during a drought. And then the population of shallow-beaked finches immediately rebounds after a rainy season. Bacteria develop a resistance to antibiotics, and viruses develop a resistance to antiviral medication. But nothing new is ever created. A bacterium remains a bacterium. A virus remains a virus. A finch remains a finch. Even the evolution fetishists do not claim that a mutating AIDS virus is on its way up the tree of life, soon to be a kangaroo. If a rapidly mutating bacterium or virus were proof of evolution, then after 3 billion years of nonstop evolution, the only life forms we would have on Earth would be extremely sturdy bacteria and viruses. Humans develop a tolerance for alcohol, tobacco, and caffeine, but no one imagines a high tolerance for alcohol will somehow lead to a new organ, like a tail or a pair of wings. Darwin's Galapagos finches are boldly cited as living proof of the creative power of natural selection. It is triumphantly stated that now there are 13 finch species in the Galapagos Islands, which allegedly evolved from a single finch species. Yes, today there are 13 species of finches on the Galapagos Islands. Guess how many there were when Darwin first discovered them in 1835? That's right. 13 species. Darwin hypothesized that the 13 species he found might have evolved from one species, just as evolutionists hypothesize that the bat might have evolved from a clumsy squirrel. The Galapagos finches are evidence of nothing but the evolutionists' ability to make up stories. If anything, the finches are a major blow to Darwin's theory of evolution. Despite major changes in the environment on the Galapagos Islands, the formation of new species has never been observed there. There were 13 species in 1835, and after more than 170 years of wild variation in the environment, mutation, and natural selection, there are still 13 species. The finch's beaks have moved back and forth in shape, and nothing more. In a 1991 Scientific American, Darwinist Peter Grant effused about the famous finches, saying that if droughts came only once a decade, natural selection would transform one species into another within 200 years. Well, it's been 170 years since Darwin first saw them, and we're still waiting. If it rained this year, the Galapagos finch population would look exactly like the finch population Darwin first found there. If it was dry, it would look like the finch population he would have found a few years later. Human breeders have not been able to produce one biologically novel structure in the laboratory, much less a new animal species, even under artificial conditions. No such demonstration exists. None has ever been provided. The fruit fly has been abused, mutilated, and stressed over the course of thousands and thousands of generations. The poor dumb creature remains what it has always been, a fruit fly in the first instance, dumb in the second. This negative result is perfectly consistent with the long history of breeding experiments, which demonstrate, beyond question, that species may be changed only within very narrow margins of variability. No practical breeder imagines, for example, that he will ever succeed in creating a chicken with antennae or a pig with a dorsal fin. Amid this dismal record, there have been a few exciting developments for the Darwiniacs. There was the discovery of a man-like ape that looked like a transitional fossil between ape and man, the long-sought-after missing link. There were drawings of embryos demonstrating that vertebrates all looked alike in the earliest stages of development. There was the peppered moth that became darker, allegedly to better camouflage itself from predatory birds, when industrial air pollution blackened the trees in England. It wasn't terribly impressive in terms of evidence, but it filled out a few pages in biology textbooks claiming evolution was a fact. And then, one by one, each of these pillars of evidence for evolution was exposed as a fraud. Ironically, each appeared to have been an intelligently designed prank. It's difficult to imagine that any other scientific theory has been beset with as many hoaxes as the theory of evolution, always a good sign of a serious scientific endeavor. On April Fool's Day, 2005, Scientific American magazine ran a mock editorial apologizing for accepting the so-called theory of evolution. Scientific American also sneered at the alleged flights of the Wright brothers in 1906, 2 years after they had flown their first airplanes. The magazine sarcastically apologized for its belief in the theory of evolution, saying scientists had dazzled us with their fancy fossils, their radiocarbon dating, and their tens of thousands of peer-reviewed journal articles. As editors, we had no business being persuaded by mountains of evidence. The only time radiocarbon dating was used in connection with the theory of evolution was the time it was used to expose the Piltdown Man as a hoax being pawned off as proof of evolution. It was one of the greatest scientific frauds of all time, right up there with the Pepsi Challenge and that commercial where ordinary laundry detergent gets red wine out of a white blouse. For half a century, Piltdown Man constituted a major piece of evidence for Darwin's theory. After decades of being embarrassed by the fossil record's stubborn refusal to come to Darwin's aid, in 1912, the Piltdown Man miraculously appeared in a gravel pit in Sussex, England. Amateur paleontologist Charles Dawson claimed to have discovered a skull with a human-like cranium and an ape-like jaw in Piltdown Quarry. It was a creature that was not quite ape, not quite man, but a transitional species between the two, rather like the actor Pauly Shore. This Pauly Shore-like fossil wouldn't have proved evolution, but it would have given evolutionists a possible link between apes and man on their imaginary tree of life. Like a doctor's excuse note written to a seventh-grade teacher signed Timmy's Mommy, it was almost uncanny how precisely Piltdown Man matched what prevailing scientific theory predicted the missing link would look like. The New York Times headline for the article on the Piltdown Man proclaimed, "Darwin Theory is Proved True." My headline the day Clinton was impeached, "God Theory is Proved True." The Piltdown fossil was peer-reviewed, so we know it would pass muster with the editors of Scientific American, still flush with success after triumphantly exposing the Ohio flight hoax. Experts confirmed the age and origin of the bones. Indeed, the Piltdown Man received the approval of Arthur Smith Woodward, the leading geologist at the British Museum, Natural History. Eoanthropus Dawsoni was born. Dawson was showered with praise, fame, and awards. If only Vanity Fair had been around, Dawson could have been photographed in his Jaguar and hailed for speaking truth to power. He was made a Fellow of the Geological Society and a Fellow of the Society of Antiquaries. He was even offered a position writing editorials for Scientific American. For more than 40 years, the Piltdown Man was taught as scientific fact. Then, in 1953, it was exposed as a complete and utter fraud, in part through the process that so dazzles the editors of Scientific American, radiocarbon dating. Note to Scientific American, steer clear of any mention of radiocarbon dating when disparaging the critics of evolution as uneducated rubes. Yes, the same process that recently helped us pin down the exact year of Helen Thomas's birth also determined that the Piltdown Man's skull was from a 1,000-year-old human fossil and the jaw from a modern orangutan. It wasn't even a particularly good fake. The jaw had been stained with potassium bichromate and the teeth filed down to make them look more human. Cher had a similar procedure done recently, and she looks amazing. Evolution's Piltdown Man makes Scientology's E-meter look like a particle accelerator at Los Alamos. There was even a Piltdown bird, an incredible fossil that was half dinosaur, half bird, which amazingly was entirely composed of white meat, had four drumsticks, and was self-basting. Archaeoraptor made the cover of National Geographic with the sensational headline, "Feathers for T-Rex?" And then Archaeoraptor was exposed as a hoax, too. On the empirical side of evolution, there was the celebrated peppered moth.